thank you for being on the Disability Guru podcast. My name is Dr. Michelle Hernandez. And would you like to introduce yourself, Laura?
Yeah, so I'm Laura Miller, and I'm a sexual health educator for people with disabilities, a coach, consultant, and community organizer.
So. Okay, and how long have you been in this capacity?
So I started in sexual health back in 2005, and then actually took a bit of a detour doing some cancer and diabetes research, and more recently came back to it when I completed my master's in 2015, when I completed my master's in sexuality. So for the last 5 years.
Oh, okay. Years. Do you identify as disabled or not?
Yes, so I'm legally blind. I have retinitis pigmentosa, and so I have a few degrees of central vision left, but all of my peripheral vision is gone. So I have very limited vision.
Do you want to give some background, like how that came to be?
Growing up, I had a fairly typical childhood, and as I became a young adult, we noticed my night vision was declining, and so request of my friends, I actually went to the doctor to get some eyeglasses to help me drive at night. And I was 23 years old, and I actually walked out at that time with the diagnosis of being legally blind. So I had lost all of my peripheral vision without really being aware of it at that time. So that was about 15 years ago now.
Oh, okay. Okay, so growing up, you had vision. And then at the age of 23, you were diagnosed and legally blind, right? And how was that? What was that adjustment like for you?
Yeah, so, you know, growing up, I had adopted society's beliefs about disability for the most part. And, you know, it was something that happened to other folks. And so, when the doctor told me I was legally blind, it really didn't hit. There was a lot of denial and a lot of what we refer to as internalized ableism, and that's the adoption of ableist beliefs. Let me back up a second and define ableism. It's the bias or discrimination and social prejudice against people with disabilities. So when society deems people with disabilities as not useful or marketable or not desirable. And so I had adopted all of those beliefs. I'd internalized all of those ableist beliefs. And so for about 12, 13 years, I really wanted nothing to do with blindness. I did not want to use my cane at all. Those kinds of things, really fearful about blindness. And 3 years ago, I found the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco. And with that experience came a very blind positive community. And so all of this internalized fear started to shift for me. And blindness became a much more positive experience and a much more empowering experience for me. And that shift has really taken place in the last 3 years or so since finding community.
Let's talk about sex education. I mean, as far as you being a sex educator, what do you think is the most needed in our school system as far as disabled people getting a sexual education, and then including, do you want to talk about how disability is not included in that?
Yes. So currently in the state of California, we have state mandate that says that all of our youth need to receive sex education in both middle school and in high school. That's the California Healthy Youth Act. And that act says that instruction must be medically accurate, sexual health information and HIV prevention, that it must be age appropriate, and it must be LGBT inclusive. That law also goes on to say that it has to be appropriate and equally available for people with disabilities, both physical and developmental. And that portion of the law currently isn't actually being implemented, especially for our blind community. So we do not have an accessible curriculum for our youth. So the state of California says we need to teach pregnancy prevention, STI prevention, anatomy, gender, all of those things to all of our youth. But in order to make this accessible to our youth who are blind or visually impaired, we really need to be looking at ways to modify the existing materials and curriculum to make it accessible to them. And currently there are no standards and there's no universal curriculum for our youth.
Which
is really unfortunate.
Right, right. So it's a huge gap that's not being looked at. And that's where your area of expertise comes in, right?
Definitely. So we do have some researchers in Northern Illinois University, Galen Kapperman and Stacy Kelly, who've been looking at this from a couple of different angles. They've been looking at what our community has received in terms of sex education, but because of the sensitive nature of the subject, they only have a sample size of about 30. And so the information we're getting is still fairly anecdotal at best. And the second piece of the research that they're looking at is how they can make these materials available to teachers for the visually impaired so that they might be able to make a teacher-made model of a male pelvis and using materials that they can buy at a hardware store for less than $15. And so they've put out some recommendations to make these models, and currently, they are in line with how we might teach a blind student about their lungs or about any other part of their body. And the third piece that they're looking at is 3D models. And they were printing 3D anatomically correct models and sending them to teachers for the visually impaired to test out with their students. Their feedback was that there was a lot of stigma associated to these anatomically correct 3D models. Basically, where we are is we have a law that says our youth need this information, and we have some very, very basic research to get us started in what will be successful.
I remember you talking about like having kind of like a girls' night out, like girls asking you to explain to them, you know, what to do as far as like safe touch, safe sex. And do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because that's a really good example.
So we had an evening where we tested out all of these different materials to see what would be accessible or useful and all of that. We ended up having an evening where I took the materials and the information that is available for our community currently, and I tested this with some of my peers, people who are independent living instructors, you know, working in access technology, all of those kinds of things in our field. And I tested the material with them, and they had some wonderful advice on how we could make this accessible. However, the conversation actually really steered towards the importance of consent and how we even talk about this in our community. There were six people there with us that evening, and none of them had received accurate sex education. None of them had received good consent information. And one of them in particular, he said that he learned about consent from a line in a movie where the woman said, "You don't ever touch a woman without her permission." And he made a mental note of that, and he has just stuck to that his whole life. And so really, it's important to teach our children about consent, but also really socialize them from an early, early age about consent. And so that's a big direction that I'm starting to take in our community, is talking about how do we create a culture of consent with our youth long before we're actually talking about sexual health or, you know, relationships that they may have.
Right, right. Because that's interesting, because I didn't get any sexual education in school either. And I had just asked my kids, I go, "Did you guys have sex ed in school?" And they're like, "Yeah, Mom." And I was like, well, I never did. So I didn't know that consent was an issue, honestly. So
folks need to know that there's three main pillars of consent. And so that's knowing exactly what somebody is agreeing to. It's expressing your intent to participate, that you're also interested in participating. And then it's the free and voluntary expression of that consent. And so all of those things need to come into play. And when we're not teaching our youth, and we often are socializing them by saying, you're going with Laura for O&M and off you go, but that youth doesn't necessarily have the agency to say, I need 5 minutes, or I don't know who Miss Laura is. Can you please tell me what I'm going to be doing with her? We haven't given them those tools. They're socialized around a lot of adults. And so these topics are so important to break down at that level. And it's also really important to give our youth opportunity to make mistakes. And so when they have the agency to say yes and no, then they can work through these real life experiences long before they ever get into a relationship, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What do you consider your do's and don'ts when it comes to sex education with disabled people, especially blindness, too? Because I noticed that, like, I don't know how to say this, but, like, when I was legally blind, people didn't think that I had low vision or that I couldn't see, you know? And so I had to make the decision whether who to tell, who not to tell. Is it going to make me more vulnerable, less? So what are your thoughts on that? I think it's really important.
Definitely. So we'll take a mainstream classroom. If you have a visually impaired or a youth who is blind in the classroom, they're receiving that information with all of their peers. And so the advice currently, if you were to make a teacher-made model for the student who's blind or visually impaired, you wouldn't want to just put that model on their desk and none of the other students have access to it, but they see that student as singled out and having special materials. And so that is a big no-no. And so the recommendations currently are, if information like that needs to take place, that it takes place in private or pre-teaching. But the Universal Design for Learning actually says that the best practices would be that that information that's made accessible to our blind or visually impaired youth should be accessible to the entire classroom. Mm-hmm. And so when I put the handmade models in the hands of our blind participants, they all felt that this would be equally useful for the sighted participants and that there needed to be models going around the class for them as well. So really, my recommendations are, we're never doing something in a classroom that singles out a blind or visually impaired student that would possibly have them be ridiculed or made fun of or any of those things, but we're actually taking an approach that would help all students be more engaged. And that really is the Universal Design for Learning, which I can go into a little bit more if you'd like.
Yeah, please.
So when I first started at the Lighthouse, I spoke with one of the people who runs an organization called CAST, which is located in Boston. And it's a nonprofit research and development organization looking at creating a universal design for learning. And they said, to their knowledge, currently no sexual health curriculum exists for universal design. Really, part of my research is, and I am new to the concept of universal design, and also because I acquired disability and blind positivity later in life, I am learning how to apply a disability positive lens to all of this. Basically, the Universal Design for Learning says that we need to represent the material in lots of different ways. That's with 3D models or raised line drawings, braille labels. It's also having multiple modes of engagement, so role-playing, brainstorming, formal class, listening to tapes, reading, all different ways of getting this information, not just lecture style with a PowerPoint. And then the final is action or expression and different ways that a student can express what they know. And so a personal example is when my son is asked to write a report, he'll give you 5 sentences. But if he can give the report orally, you need to set a time limit because he'll be up there for an hour. Really looking at how we can apply a universal design to sex education so that the most students in the class can benefit, not just singling out our blind or visually impaired student.
That is so awesome. That is so great. I remember you giving an example about not like using different senses and different modalities, like a multimodal transmission model. Do you want to talk more, a little bit more about that, or a little bit about that?
If you take an example like giving a lecture on sexually transmitted infections, typically you might have some PowerPoint pictures or some slides up there, and you would explain, you know, when you might need to go to the doctor or what you might need to look for and how you might prevent that. And taking a more universal design would actually give the students a chance to possibly sit and brainstorm what it might look like to have that discussion with a peer for the first time. And so now they're leaving the classroom with some actual tools for how to talk about this. They haven't just passively sat and watched a presentation taking place up on the board. And I know for myself as an adult learner, having the opportunity to have those discussions has greatly enhanced everything from consent to the relationships that I end up in.
You remember the conversation we had about the STDs and how you would tell the person, well, if it smells like this down there, it might be this, or if it itches. You know, I really like those examples that you gave because I never thought about that, and it totally reflects universal design.
One of the current recommendations out there to teach about an STI would be to mix egg whites and confectioner's sugar and some fish oil. And my concern with that is that it is actually fear-mongering sort of at its best. And so if we have students that then can see and smell and feel, you know, the frothy discharge or the smell, that actually is really adding a fearful approach. And what would be better is to explain all of that, that if there's a frothy discharge or if there's a strong smell, those might be times that you need to go to the doctor. But it's also, you're including in the curriculum that there are many symptoms, there are many STIs that don't have symptoms. So if we're choosing to make models that just show the worst of the worst symptoms, then we have kids who aren't going to the doctor for their regular checkups or when they need to because they don't think anything's wrong.
Perfect.
And at the same time, taking what works really well from that model, you can take the egg whites and the confectioner's sugar and mix to make different representations of mucus. And so as a sex educator, you could use that to show family planning or how mucus may change during a woman's cycle. That's a wonderful tool to show. And that's a tool for everyone, not just the blind student, but all of the students get to take the benefits from that. So we're really looking at what's out there and applying a sex positive and blind positive universal design to the information that currently exists.
Right. And I understand you going to SF State and getting, was it a master's in sex education?
So I graduated in 2009 with a master's in public health from San Francisco State. And then in 2015 with a master's in sexuality from San Francisco State. And both of those degrees took place before I found the Lighthouse for the Blind and the Blind Positive Community. And so what I did not realize and know was I was deeply steeped in the medical model of disability. And I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with
that.
Yeah,
oh, no, you can go. Why don't you go ahead and give an example or explain it, if you will.
So the medical model, when the medical community really defines people by their disabilities or their impairments or their differences, and it's where we look at what's wrong with a person and not necessarily at what a person needs. And it can often lead to lower expectations, losing independence, that kind of stuff. For me, it really manifested in I wasn't blind positive. I wasn't comfortable using my cane. I spent a lot of time raising money for charity for cures for blindness. And what the shift that needed to take place that happened after I'd finished both of those degrees was finding community and finding the social model. And that is the model that's actually been designed in the disability communities that say disability is a way of life. It's that disability is caused by how society is organized, not by our personal impairments or our differences. Removing barriers helps people with disabilities. It's not the disability itself that's the barrier. For me, it just started to really unpack the white cane. That was my first thing. I had spent 13 years hating this cane. And now 3 years after being in a blind positive community, I feel so empowered when I grab my cane. And that is also working through a lot of the internalized ableism, questioning these models, questioning why my search for the cure was so important when really I needed blindness skills. I needed the cane. I needed to stop hiding and to stop being so fearful. So that was the biggest switch for me. And really those programs when I was in school, they were taking a cultural humility approach. We were talking a lot about being aware of other cultures and cultural differences and talking a lot about racism and inclusion from that perspective. And now we're starting to see a shift, and I am, in my conversations, encouraging a shift to a disability humility approach. That's inclusion, accessibility, equitability, centering disabled people's voices, and taking a much more disability justice approach to sex education and to public health as well.
That is so awesome. And so do you want to talk about what you're doing in the future and like how, you know, did you have any classes in your getting your graduate degrees on sex education and disability, or is this something that now you're going back to your school and educating people about?
So I definitely am doing a lot of going back and educating and the importance of disability humility and including people with disabilities in public health and sexuality. And so one of the first things I have coming up on March 18th is actually with you, Michelle, at San Francisco State. And we're going to be doing a panel, Let's Meet at the Intersection, talking about sex and disability. And that's March 18th. And we will be talking in much more depth about a lot of these conversations that we've just started here. And especially the lack of this knowledge in our academic institutions and the importance of having these conversations. And then I will be doing a disability rights or civil rights panel with the Paul Longmore Institute at Foster City Library on March 20th, and that's at 7 p.m. And then Building a Culture of Consent in the Blind Community is a presentation I will be doing at the California Transcribers and Educators for the Blind and Visually Impaired. And that's in April 14th in Burlingame. So just doing a lot of advocacy, a lot of panels, a lot of presentations to educators and providers and people who work with folks with disabilities, trying to get these conversations so that people aren't being held back for 13 years. If I could go back, I would love to have unpacked my ableism much earlier on and got out of my way, because I spent a lot of wasted time in fear.
And do you want to just real quick talk about disability humility and what that means? You know, just educate my listeners too, because I don't think, I mean, before I talked to you, wasn't really familiar with that word and how it, you know, what was the proper way to use it. Do you want to explain that a little bit?
Actually, the 10 principles of disability justice that were started by Sins Invalid might actually be a little bit of a better framework for thinking about it. And those principles are that the movement is intersectional, that it is the leadership of the most impacted, so folks with disabilities leading the music movement, anti-capitalist politics, that it's not about productivity, it's not about being a taxpaying member of society, cross-movement solidarity, so that we're doing disability justice and LGBT organizing and just all across the board, that this is an intersectional conversation that's taking place. Recognizing wholeness of folks with disabilities, the sustainability of the movement, a commitment to the cross-disability solidarity, interdependence, collective access, and then collective liberation. And they go into that in much more detail, but it really is, how do we take a disability humility? How do we take our disabled voices and center them? Because, like I said, when I came on the scene, I thought we just needed to add accessibility to sexual health. And that isn't the case. We need to be having these conversations about ableism, internalized ableism, medical model, social model. We need to be unpacking all the way back to that level so that our kids have access to the same information that their peers do.
Exactly.
And it isn't happening later in life the way I had to get it.
Yeah, no, it makes sense to me, because that's basically, you know, when I grew up, that's why I wanted to become a doctor, because I wanted to find a cure for my disease, because I fell into the, you know, the whole medical model of like, oh, well, there's something wrong with you, and we don't know why. And I thought, well, I have to be a doctor. I have to be like them so I can fix me. And then in fixing me, I can be better. But actually, see, it's more of a disability humility approach, and I should accept me first and then be comfortable and empowered by who I am, and not as a positive thing, not as a negative. So thank you for sharing that, and thank you. Do you have any social media where people can follow you or keep in touch?
I can be found at Facebook at Laura Miller, and my last name is spelled M-I-L-L-A-R, so I'm fairly easy to find. I could also be reached at laura@lauramiller.com. And again, that's with an M-I-L-L-A-R.
And you're available for booking and presentations and conferences and speaking engagements and all that good stuff?
Definitely. I am interested in having these conversations with anyone who is interested, folks with disabilities, the organizations that serve them, and their family members.
Thank you so much, Laura, for being on Disability Guru Podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, for Michelle, for having me. I really, really appreciate it.